Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we have a quite joyful program today because we're featuring marvelous products from three great ladies who happen to have not only great taste, but also are very savvy entrepreneurs. First off is a longtime favorite of ours. Listen to Jill Giacomini-Bosch talk about her prize-winning, stunning Point Reyes Bay Blue cheese. It's been a long time, but it's good talking to you again, Jill Giacomini-Bosch. The subject is, it was precipitated by this review and update by the fact that your Point Reyes Bay Blue cheese took the best cheese in an absolutely one of the most crowded fields at the Summer Fancy Food Show in New York. I just envision oceans of cheese at that event. And
more than you could possibly imagine.
Oh, it's just absolutely amazing. And I actually got tired of tasting cheese at the Fancy Food Show.
Were you there in person?
Yes. We wouldn't miss the Fancy Food Show. It's a highlight of our, for our sales and marketing team every year. We've been going actually since 2000 consistently and having our own booth, and we're actually always situated in the American Cheese Aisle, which is hosted, sponsored by the American Cheese Society, our industry trade association. So it's really become a destination location for retailers and distributors that are really selecting, what areas of the show they're going to be covering, because in 3 days you simply can't do it all.
I know. Now they've
advanced.
So we're
surrounded by all sorts of, wonderful, representatives from the, American artisanal, cheese movement, which is so great to be, in such good company.
A specialty food association, the Fancy Food Show has grown and grown and grown to its just unimaginably huge. But they've given us some tools now. I'm talking about media, and it would be also buyers, tools to navigate the show, high technology tools, more or less. Although it's still just, it's a gargantuan effort to cover everything.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. So you have to certainly, even if you can walk the whole show, you've got to pick and choose what you're going to sample and taste very, very carefully. Otherwise, you'd overload, sensory overload for sure.
Oh, that's for sure.
Halfway through.
But anyway, it was quite an honor to come out of that craziness at the top of the heap here.
Yeah.
So congratulations.
I can't even tell you really how much this means to us. The Specialty Food Association has been such a beacon of light for us, and they've proven to be such great resource for young startup companies, and their ability to attract so many wonderful buyers from across the country, both at the San Francisco Winter Show as well as the New York Show in the summertime. That is been so beneficial to us really establishing ourselves since we got started in 2000. And every year we really look forward to being there, and now, not only introducing ourselves to potential new customers, but being able to spend some good quality time with the existing customers we've made through the years. But we started entering the SOFI Awards just in, 2010. We felt that we were ready to compete, and it's just been so thrilling every year to either at least be named a finalist or to be able to walk away with one of the gold statues after the show is over. Because it's an affirmation, really, that our peers in the specialty food industry are really understanding and approving and celebrating what it is we do and why we work so hard. But Original Blue, our flagship cheese, won for Best Cheese of the Year in 2011. Toma, our farmer's cheese, won for Best Cheese of the Year in 2013. And then now this year, Bay Blue won. So it's kind of an embarrassment of riches. We're just thrilled.
Here's what it is, I think, and you're too modest to say this, so I'll say it for you. But it has to be a validation of everything you chose to do at Point Reyes, when as a family you reunited around making cheese. And you talk about wanting to show what it is that when we raise our cows this way and we milk them this way and we handle their product this way, this is why we get the results we get.
But a lot of it's about paying respect to that process in our creamery. I always tell folks that come here to the farm, if we do our job right, our cheese doesn't just taste like our milk, but it tastes like our farm. It tastes like the grass. It tastes like the climate and the region. You know, we're so proud of the fact that we're farmstead, which means that we exclusively use our own milk supply right here on the farm to make the finished product, the cheese. We're so happy to have that ability that we want to celebrate it, and we want our cheese to taste like it really truly can't be duplicated. Our recipes can't be duplicated anywhere else.
So it's really special. It's even more selective than like a Stilton or a Gorgonzola.
Oh, yeah, it's farmstead.
Because it's single.
Single origin.
Single origin. That's really quite amazing.
I mean, they take mm-hmm. these cows from birth to...
Yeah, I know. I read all about it. Yes. Oh.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to ask Jill, in case somebody hadn't known the story or listened to a previous interview, just recap the interesting family association to do with this cheese company.
Sure. Yeah. So my mom and dad, Bob and Dean Giacomini, they bought our farm in 1959. My sisters and I'm the youngest of four daughters, no sons in the family. We were raised here on the property. We have about 720 acres, and we sit right alongside Tamales Bay, which feeds out to the Pacific in West Marin County. So we're about exactly an hour from the Golden Gate Bridge. So
we've been there. We ate oysters from Tamales Bay, and what's the name of
probably Hog Lake? Island Oyster Company or yes, Tamales Bay Oyster Company.
Exactly. No,
they're both right
Hog
in
Island.
Our region
Hog
here.
Hog Island.
And Hog Island. Yeah.
And there's a San Francisco restaurateur who has a B&B right on Tamales Bay, and we stayed there.
Yes. Yeah. You're probably thinking of Nick's Cove.
Nick's Cove, exactly, exactly. So we know exactly where you are. We probably waved at some of your cows.
You might have. So we have a dairy farm here that my parents started and ran very successfully for the first 42 years. My dad, my mom, it was very conventional, very traditional sized dairy here for the region. On average, they were milking about 300 Holsteins, selling all of the fluid milk. My dad had a very small staff that he was overseeing. He was even doing a lot of the milking himself in the first few years. My mom was managing the finances. You know, she was paying the bills, and you know, they were raising kids and, you know, just living a very nice, very, like I said, very, for a very conventional small-sized dairy here for the state of California. It was in the late 90s when my mom and dad kind of gathered my sisters and I around the table and said, hey, you haven't thus far expressed interest in coming back to the farm. I should back up and tell you that, you know, when we went off to college, we basically never came back. And while we certainly had an affinity for the land and the farm, we had all decided for personal reasons that agriculture and dairy specifically was not of interest in our personal career choices, our career paths. We were all in business. I had a sister in finance, a sister in sales. I was in marketing and advertising. And I had one sister who was just, who was at home with her kids. And anyway, there came a time, you know, as there does for all, you know, multi-generational family farms, where the first generation has to sit down with the kids and make the hard decision of, you know, what do we do with the farm as we're getting older? And their love of the land was only going to, you know, keep them invigorated to continue operating the operation as it stood for so long. They weren't ready to retire immediately, but it was the time for them to make the decision, do we begin the process to scale back the business and then sell the property, or do we open it up for you guys to possibly come back?
So what happened?
Well, I think you know what happened.
We know it was funny because
I always say that I'm an example of never say never in life, because if you asked me as a teen or as a young adult if I would come back to the farm, I would have said, oh, no, absolutely not for me. But I was married and just starting to have children myself and looking to kind of get out of the rat race a bit. I was My personal background was in advertising and marketing and high tech. So I was in Silicon Valley working 60-plus hour weeks and just kind of doing the grind and loving it. But on the other hand, knowing that there was no way I could continue that lifestyle and have start to raise a family myself at the same time. And my sisters were kind of in similar positions. And we, because of our, you know, love for the land and wanting to create a legacy for what our parents had started here, we thought, hey, let's take a look at doing something as a value-added business to that would be very complementary to what my parents had started, but something that might be able to sustain us if we were to come back to the farm and work on it ourselves.
I was just thinking that as a dairy farm producing whole milk, this wasn't a farm that was going to be able to support four families.
No, exactly.
You had to come up with something else that generated more profit.
Mm-hmm.
I did want to.
Yeah, we would have to diversify the operation, and you know, we always had talked loosely as a family that wouldn't it be great to make cheese here on the farm. And I'll be honest, my dad was frustrated, you know, for years and years to see that milk truck pull away every morning,
right,
with the, you know, the fruit of his labor inside to be processed and branded by another company. Our local creamery where we sell our milk, Clover Stornetta, you know, they kind of got to take the glory for
wonderful
his hard
milk.
Work. And so we always thought, God, if I could ever do something on my own, it would be cheese, and we'd be able to brand it specifically to this farm and this region and be able to offer it to Bay Area consumers to represent everything that he knew he was doing right, from his practices to raising his animals to always milking and so forth. So anyway, we decided to, my sisters and I, to put our heads together and do some research to write an initial business plan to really just assess the viability of starting an artisanal cheese creamery here on the property to use exclusively our own milk. In doing so, we saw that there was this burgeoning artisan cheese movement really going on in the U.S. and that there was a shortage of certain types of cheeses. We also realized, you know, a lot of the people that had made a successful business out of getting into this little niche industry were right here in our backyard. We thought, wow, we can really learn from them. And we started reaching out and talking to folks like the Bice family over at Redwood Hill, Laura Chanel and her team in Sonoma County, Mary Keene up at Cypress Grove in Humboldt County, and then the Cowgirls, Peg Smith and Sue Conley. They had just gotten started about 3 years prior to us here right in Point Reyes, making great quality artisanal small batch.
Okay, so they're neighbors.
So
they're practically neighbors now.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting thing. I'm guessing that your website, which we'll include in the conversation in just a minute. I want to say something here that we'll recommend to people, that they come and look at the pictures that you have there. I'm sure you have pictures of the land and the cows.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
This doesn't look like the California that people know as California. It really doesn't. It looks like another country. It's a very beautiful country, but it's a very different country from the one that people associate with California. I'm sure you agree there.
Mm-hmm. Well, different times of year it does. You know, right now we're very golden. I think we're looking pretty typical with the rest of the state. But in the green season, pretty much, you know, December through June, it looks like Ireland. Beautiful rolling hills with just really thick, lush pastures for our animals. And if any of your listeners are familiar with the Happy Cow commercials coming from California, this is where a lot of those commercials have been filmed.
So you've been producing these award-winning cheeses, but you have other ventures, such as, tell us about the fork.
Oh, sure. Well, let me just finish the story really quick. So, long story short, we did decide to jump in. My sisters and I quit our day jobs, forewent any kind of compensation other than cheese for the first 3 years so we could reinvest all the earnings into the business. We launched the company on August 1st, so it is our anniversary month right now. August 1st of 2000 with the production of our first vat of Point Reyes Original Blue, which is our flagship cheese. And for the first 9 years, that is the only cheese that we produced. And that's really how we got our feet wet here in the industry and established our brand and certainly learned the, you know, intricacies of getting an artisanal and perishable product to market across the country. You know, again, there were four of us, so we weren't doing this really as a hobby business. We were doing this to really establish ourselves on a national scale as quickly as possible. And so in those first 9 years, we were able to learn merchandising and marketing, you know, on top of production, on top of the dairy side of the business, distribution, of course, and make a name for ourselves. And once we had done that, we started adding to our product line. We have an amazing, wonderful head cheesemaker. His name is Kuba Hemmerling, and he actually joined us into 2000, the beginning of 2009, with the specific purpose of helping us grow our product line because we were ready at that point. And so the first cheese that we came out with was Toma, which is our kind of real buttery flavored farmer's cheese. Then after that, we introduced a fresh mozzarella, which we just sell here regionally in Northern California because it's very perishable. It only has a three-week shelf life.
I've never had that at all.
Yeah, it's really wonderful. Next, on your next trip to California, we'll get you some.
Okay.
That actually just won second place for fresh mozzarella at the American Cheese Society last week in Providence, Rhode Island, which was exciting. And then Bay Blue, the cheese that we'll be talking about shortly, we introduced to the market in 2012. And now we're working on some other new cheeses not ready for prime time yet to discuss. But another form of diversification for us was in 2010 when we entered into the world of agritourism, very popular overseas, and we're starting to see it here in the States, especially here in Northern California with a lot of the wineries and even with some of the other folks in dairy and row crops. But it's the Fork, which we refer to as a culinary and educational center. And really it was in response to the fact that for many, many years we were fielding phone calls from our fans and our consumers that wanted to, you know, learn about us on a deeper level and come to the farm and meet our animals and learn about our farming practices and see in person how we make our cheese and buy from us and taste our cheese right here, you know, while they're as part of their experience. And we just didn't have a place, you know, to host them. And learning from, you know, the wine industry right here to our east, you know, that we thought, there's a lot of successful, you know, hospitality ventures in wine that go beyond just tasting rooms, where they're really teaching their customers about how they farm and how they make their wine and really creating a brand loyalty that is unsurpassed, because once you can get a customer there and engaging with you and your staff, you know, you can have a customer for life. So that's what we decided to emulate with the Fork. And so, again, we refer to it as an educational and culinary center. I like to tell people that, you know, you're taking, when people come to the Fork, they're taking a real deep dive on what farm-to-table is actually all about, the practices, the people. The first thing we do after they arrive is we get them out on a 45-minute walking farm tour, and they're meeting several of our employees, not just one tour guide. They're meeting our animals that range from birth all the way through the production cycle. They're seeing our cows being milked. They're seeing them being fed. They might even see a live birth because we typically have one a day, so that's a pretty common occurrence here.
Oh, that's a lot, one a day.
and they can view into our creamery through a viewing window, and we explain what's going on depending upon what time of day it is and what cheese is actually being made inside. And then they come back to the Fork itself, and they participate in a focused cheese tasting with one of our employees, where there's a real deeper understanding at that point of the flavors of the cheese and what creates those flavors, because they've just learned about, you know, how we feed our animals, how we graze our animals, how we raise them from birth. They learn about the pasture grass itself and what it is that we're harvesting here every year, so they can kind of really comprehend the cause and effect of what great care and sustainable farming practices can create in terms of milk flavor and then great cheese quality. And then, if depending upon what type of educational experience a guest might be signed up for, they might be able to participate in a hands-on cooking class with our executive chef. They might sit for a demo-style cooking class with a guest chef that we bring in from all over Northern California. They might participate in a sensory evaluation of tasting our cheeses with locally produced wine or craft beer. Or they might just be here for a good time and participate in a farm lunch, a farm brunch, a farm dinner. We offer all sorts of great culinary add-ons to our farm tours. Bottom line is we want our guests to leave really feeling inspired and invigorated about supporting, the local farm movement here in California.
Now in 30 seconds or less, tell our listeners about Bay Blue. Let's get Bay Blue in there before we forget.
I wanted to say that, you have like a sentimental favorite in your original cheese, your original blue cheese.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
if you don't mind my saying so, Bay Blue is light years in terms of sophisticated flavor, in my mind, to the original. Why?
Well, they're two totally different cheeses. People are constantly asking, what's your favorite? I'm like, are you kidding me? They're like my children. I like them all for different reasons and sometimes more than others on certain days. Original Blue is our, is our very classic style. It's akin to a very traditional, classic cow's milk cheese from, blue cheese from France or from, or a Danish style. It's very, very, very creamy. It's spreadable almost like butter. It's got a lot of sweet milky flavors up front, and then it has a full flavored peppery finish. Bay Blue, on the other hand, is more akin to a British Stilton. It's got a fudgy, dense texture. It's got a lot of umami flavors up front. You've got some earthiness, some mushroom, a little bit of sourdough yeastiness, but the finish is very mellow. For a blue, even though it looks like it's going to pack a punch, it really doesn't. It's very mild, but the finish is very sweet, almost like salted caramel or butterscotch. So it's got this layered effect. There's a complexity of flavor from start to finish, and then it lingers on your palate, really creating just this kind of wonderful, sensory experience that people, can't get enough of. It also has a beautiful crust, natural rind, so it's a gorgeous addition to a cheese board or after dinner cheese course.
Yeah, it looks like the ideal cheese is what it looks like.
It's good stuff. I'm eating it three times a day.
Well, good. I love it. You were worried about what to do with the extra and how to store it. I don't think you're going to have that. You're going to have that problem in the end.
It's going to last me a week. And if Miss Anne wants more, which she shall have, then it won't last that long, and we'll have to come begging for more. Truly, this is a wonderful family experience. It's a wonderful American story with. And I think the fact that the Giacominis obviously come from a different place where family is even more important probably has a lot to do with how you got to be the way you are. And so we thank you for sharing this conversation with us, Jill, and I'm sure we'll talk again soon.
Okay, great. That sounds wonderful. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
Enjoy the cheese.
We will.
Of course.
Yeah. And
okay.
I wish we could see each other soon. We'll let you know.
Hopefully soon.
West. Okay.
Okay.
Jill.
All right.
Thanks
Thank
again.
You.
Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
And I'm going to make some burgers for lunch very shortly, and guess what I might put on top? A dab of Point Reyes Bay Blue, and then I'll pop it under the Gorilla. And to make sure it melts all over the burgers, and it'll be wonderful.
You're making me jealous.
And before we move on, I guess we ought to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Well, we sure had a lot of fun talking to our next guest, Natasha Case, who makes, her company is called Cool House, And it's a little complicated. The concept has to do with architecture. She doesn't make ice cream in the shape of buildings. She just names her ice creams, pints, sandwiches, and bars after famous architects. But there's more to this than that just meets the eye, and she will explain her concept. My eye was caught by the title of this product, Cool House, spelt with a C instead of a K, but being an old architecture buff, I immediately responded to Natasha Case, who we're going to be talking to today, who founded an ice cream company based on explain your concept. Would you please, Natasha?
Sure, yes. So it is architecturally inspired gourmet ice cream. I think we're the only one that has ever existed and the only one that will ever exist.
Yeah, well, maybe you could, what in your background made you go in this direction? You were inspired by how many years in architecture?
Yes, so my background is in architecture and design. I went to Berkeley for undergrad and then UCLA for grad school. And while I was in school, I just started to feel like, you know, in architecture, part of the dialogue was kind of getting out of touch with public and the people who architecture really depends on, which is the clients and those who are going to use the spaces. And so I, you know, really became interested in how can we make architecture more fun and accessible and relatable, understandable for those people, and there's value in that. So I started to, great way to bring fun and access to anything is with food. So I started to play around with bringing food into the studio, if you will. So I made some edible scale models and, did some pop-up dinners and different products. At UCLA, we didn't have thesis, we had independent study, but my independent study was about mobile food and how you could break apart and put together a food truck to make all these different, eating environments. So
do you know a company called Bompas in London?
Yes, Bompas and Parr, one of my favorites.
Because they do the scale models in Jell-O.
Yes. You know what's funny is the other founder of Cool House, Freya, who we're actually married, she was no longer in the day-to-day of Cool House. She now has a gourmet jelly shot company. So it's really funny. The Bompas and Parr has inspired us even more than we think because she's fully, you know, in the jelly world, although they don't look like, you know, parliament buildings in the UK. But
well, you know, the funny thing is, though, I finally saw it in real life. They did some of these models for was it the 50 best restaurants in the world?
I think so,
it did not have the impact in real space as it does in the photographs.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Because
I have two of their books, but in fact, you could hardly see them, and they just didn't stand out at all. I was surprised.
They look kind of lumpy.
They didn't do well.
They didn't have hard edges like you would want if you were reminiscent of the architecture of a building.
Wow, maybe there's going to be said they're more. Yeah, you don't want to get too up close.
They do. Yeah. They work in the photographs, especially the ones that have the interior.
Yeah, because they light them up too, right?
Yeah,
and that helps.
Right. So anyhow, let's back to this. I mean, are you fulfilling your mission with your company? You make ice bars, you make ice by the ice cream by the pint, and you make what's described as the best ice cream sandwiches in the world.
That's right, without a doubt. Say yes, the original mission statement was very much, we called it architecture, food plus architecture. And it definitely, yes, it's still very much a part of the brand, you know, naming the ice cream and cookie combinations in the sandwiches or the pint flavors, the bar flavors, after architects. For example, we were just discussing the Louis Bacon. This is our bacon ice cream after Louis Bacon. The Nice Vanilla Rum. You know, there's the punny side of things, which I think does make it fun and approachable way. The Mies Vanilla Roe is the anti-intimidation factor and, the story, discussion piece. But at the end of the day, if you just have the delicious product and you didn't necessarily pick up on the architectural side, that's okay too. You know,
yeah,
there's
that's
nothing
what it is
wrong
too.
With that.
It's very clearly delicious. I mean, how did you put that together without a food background?
I was a career eater. A passionate hobby. I think there's a lot of autodidacts in the food world because we do all, it is such a big part of our existence. And for me, it just, you know, was always, I think I was the one in the friend circle, you know, hosting dinners the most and reading about food online. And so much, even since we launched, has become even more about access, sharing recipes and people really wanting to kind of flaunt their latest meal. So I think just having the instincts and having the care and the passion for it, and I will say ice cream in particular, when I started making it, I mean, once you get the foundation, and I don't mean an architectural pun by saying foundation, once you get the foundation, it's a great canvas for experimentation because you can kind of, it's not like baking where you kind of have to set it up perfectly and put it in the oven. You know, the ice cream is a little bit more interactive, almost kind of like making a sauce or cooking something on a stovetop. You can definitely fine-tune your craft without, you know, having a culinary degree.
But let's suppose somebody's not into, I guess what we're talking about here is shapes. I mean, what architecture and your ice cream have in common is unusual shapes. And maybe even you use the ice cream to bribe the client so that he's nice to the architect. Hold on a second. Let me get a chance to say something. Yeah. I don't get much of a word in edgeways. Let me try. The other part of it that's amazing is all the absolutely amazing flavors. Talk to us about some of the more esoteric, shall we say.
Right, and I would say more the architectural side is, you know, yes, the sandwiches kind of, you could say they look like little buildings, maybe like a little geodesic dome is a scoop, like a Bucky Fuller scoop, or kind of like the Stratosphere House in L.A. by Lautner. But, I think, and I make that point because part of, I think, what the ice cream does, especially the adventurous flavors, is to sort of deconstruct certain dishes or flavor profiles that we love. And I think some of our most adventurous flavors, for example, fried chicken and waffles ice cream, that is a signature L.A. dish that you would never expect to see in ice cream, but there's a way to make it work. We made a fried chicken caramel, which was homemade caramel from scratch. We infused it with organic fried chicken skins. And then strain the skins, and you add sage, cayenne, and black pepper, and then swirl that into brown butter ice cream with waffle bits, and it tastes like the experience of having fried chicken and waffle, but an ice cream.
It's amazing. I'm just absolutely amazing.
Yeah, there's a lot of fun you can have with it. We're also known for a lot of our boozy ice creams. Lucky Charms, we call Irish breakfast.
Yes, that's funny.
Yeah, I have a Jewish deli menu out now. We have a candied pastrami ice cream. We did a rye and cream cheese ice cream. Oh, so we like to really deconstruct those flavors and make them work where you least expect them. And those are some of our most edgy flavors.
Now, I mean, you have a very large inventory of flavors. I mean, do you rotate through them or what do you do?
Yeah, we have a core menu that we always offer, which are flavors really people expect to see, like our dirty mint chip or our salted caramel. And then we have seasonal flavors that we switch out four times a year. You know, some of it has to do with, like, the seasonal harvest. Some, honestly, is just, you know, I kind of am the flavor inventor, so whatever's on my mind that season, for example, this Jewish deli menu it's not necessarily having to do with fall, which is when we're going to launch most of it. But it's just, you know, something I feel like is of the moment is a lot of contemporaries in the food biz kind of reinventing the Jewish deli concept.
Well, now, I mean, you have a lot of competition in California, don't you?
Yes.
right. Yeah, I've always wanted to go to the place, Slocum in, what's this first
name? Humphrey Slocum.
Humphrey Slocum in San Francisco, and I always forget about it when we're there. they're wild. We interviewed them several years ago, actually.
Oh, really? How cool.
and then, of course, right out of the gate, we interviewed Jenny Bauer of Jenny Splendid.
Right.
But she came out with a whole new thing based on Impressionist art, and I jumped on that, as you can well imagine, but that was just before the Listeria hit.
Right. Oh, man, that was a rough one.
Oh, that's tough. Yeah.
I know. So. I feel for them, but they're making some great concerted efforts to rebound and refocus, I think, some different some different strategies.
Yeah, well, she's really smart. I don't think that Bluebell's doing very much. I mean, I think they're
right.
I think the most interesting thing, and I mentioned this to you, because you could very well be in the same situation if you weren't really scrupulous. They apparently knew for 2 years beforehand that there was a Listeria infection or contamination, and they still sent out, and there were something like 7 people who died, and this would be the first case where they would actually charge them with murder.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
No, that's rather amazing.
I didn't know that.
If they prove that they knowingly sent out stuff that was contaminated with Listeria and 7 people died from it, they are eligible for indictment for murder.
I don't know. Eligible would not quite be the word I would use.
Maybe not. But so anyhow, I mean, that's a whole new side of the food manufacturing that I don't think anybody has considered. We've all talked about food safety, but what do you do in a case like this? You do what Jenny did, closed down everything, even though she did not actually have anybody get sick or die with her product.
Yeah, right, absolutely.
Oh, that wasn't Jenny.
No, that was the Bluebell people in Texas.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, you lost me altogether there.
Oh, yeah, no, Jenny did what she had to do. She closed down everything. I mean, stopped production.
Yeah, I mean, these people are from Texas. What do you expect?
He has no filters, I'll just warn you.
We're making the politics clear.
I mean, it's really. Did you watch the debate?
I watched what I could handle.
We're talking about Texas. I can't understand how someone like Ted Cruz can be considered sane.
Oh, come on. We can't talk about that.
No, we should.
Off the record.
There we go. Well, no.
Okay, let's get back to the Cool House ice cream here. yeah. I mean, you see, you founded the company when?
2009.
Okay.
2009.
So was it a hit right off the bat?
I will say that pretty quickly, we launched at Coachella, which is a huge music festival in Southern California in the desert.
Oh, yeah, sure.
It did go viral pretty quickly because, large audience to launch to, and I had a friend who wrote for Curb, which is like the real estate sister blog of Eater, as you probably know, and he did a piece. It wasn't even that nice. It wasn't even that praising. It was like, so apparently there was architectural ice cream at Coachella. We don't really get it, but it was a hit. It's like, thanks, Dan, for such a lovely article. But the piece really got picked up and went, it really did go viral. So, and then also with social media, just sort of beginning the way that we know it now. I like to say we grew up with social media, but it was a great way to get a microphone to the brand without having to spend a lot of money. We immediately were catering for office parties and hitting the streets doing vending. So we did, we were able to experience growth and get in the black quite quickly, comparatively.
And what is your market? I mean, and where is it?
The trademark?
No, your market. I mean,
market.
Yeah. Is it?
It's different for different parts of the business. We started with Crux. We now have 10 nationally. We have them here in L.A., in Dallas, and in New York.
You have scoop shops.
Those are the trucks.
Oh, they're trucks. Okay.
Yeah, the trucks. For our scoop shops, we have 2 in L.A. We have 1 in Culver City and 1 in Old Town Pasadena. But then we're distributed all around the country. We're in 4,000 grocery stores, or we will be by the end of the year. So... everything from the more boutique markets, like, even smaller than a Whole Foods, to stores like Kroger and Safeway, are carrying the line. So
that's
pretty much everywhere. Yeah. Yeah. You can go on our website and search under retailers by zip code, and you can see there's really a lot.
And your website is?
EatCoolHouse.com, EatCoolHouse.com.
Right. And do you take orders on internet orders too?
Do you take internet orders? We do have an online store and ship anywhere in the country. It's not a huge part of our business because shipping ice cream on dry ice, it does get expensive. But it's something we can do, and we do have a pint and sandwich of the month club. So we have a good amount of time for that.
Yeah, that's good. Sign me up for that one. That's good.
Right.
Sandwich of the month. That's pretty good. Where do you see your business growing?
Really, the wholesale distribution is huge growth for us. You know, adding retailers, expanding the product line, taking that wherever it can go, taking it to venues you wouldn't necessarily expect. For example, stadiums where we have been sold before. We're sold at Urban Outfitters. So fashion stores can carry the line as long as they have a freezer. We're expanding a lot with our fast casual partners like burger and pizza and Mexican multi-unit gourmet fast casual. There's so much more growth that could be happening, and we're really excited to see it through.
Wow. Well, I think it's very exciting to see it all exploding like this.
Right. No, me too.
Yeah. I mean, we have friends who started a custom, you know, artisanal ice cream thing, but it's going to be a long time until they make a hit like yours. I mean, they started out as a CSA, which isn't a bad idea. But,
no, absolutely. Yeah. Happens all the time.
The trouble is they have to shut down ice cream production when they go deliver.
That's right, exactly.
Well, yeah. It's just a startup.
Yeah, they haven't built their population right. Now, does the 3D printer open up new horizons for you in terms of architectural structures in ice cream?
I would say no, because the ice cream is not really a material that, you know, has much to do with what you'd ever print with. And also, to me, I'm the least interested of all the sides that architecture could play into product. Making it look like a building, for me, it just doesn't really do it so much as, you know, the names and the stories, but also for me, like, I really do the designing of the brand. Like, I do all the packaging design, you know, a lot about the interiors, the truck design, the marketing materials, the sales materials. And so it's almost like, what would it look like if a trained architect created a brand, envisioned a brand? And that's what I'm doing. And that's also, I think, part of the story is when people come to learn that my background was in architecture, it's like, oh, well, here's a unique application of those skills. And that also, I think, educates them and makes architecture feel more like something that's more relatable in that way as well.
Well, I think you're onto a great idea here, and I think that I love the idea that the skills that you have could be put to use in something that makes money.
Yeah, me too.
Well, I really thank you for introducing us to your product, and also to talk to us about it. And keep up the good work.
Thank you so much. I will absolutely do that.
Thanks, Natasha.
I mean, got the website in there, talked about the channels and the product and the story. I really enjoyed talking with you guys. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, great. Well, I think we have a lot in common, probably.
Yes.
Right. Anyhow, well, I wish you continued success.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I really
and so
it.
I'll keep my eyes out to see what you happen to
Sounds
come
great.
Up with next.
Keep eating ice cream. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And here we are again. Who knew that chewing gum could be so stylish, chic, an accessory as well as a, I don't know what you call it, a habit, chewing gum? A lifestyle, maybe.
I don't know what you call it, but it's a beautiful design exercise. Makes you want to go back to your childhood or something. With a little bit of Romeo and Juliet mixed in, you'll see.
Well, you know, I've been around food and specialty food products for quite a long time, and it's rare that I'm just totally astounded, but I was, by a product called Simply Gum. We're going to be talking to the inventor, the founder, and the CEO, Carole Prochain, which I think means you're next, but I'm not really sure, and neither is she. Welcome to On the Menu, Carole.
Thank you very much for having me.
Your product is called Simply Gum. I was just amazed because, first of all, I still remember the era of chewing gum with things like Wrigley, Spearmint, and Juicy Fruit, and Chiclets, which you could explain to us why that was called Chiclets, and also with the fact that it was viewed as rude to do in public. And when I was in school, the nuns would absolutely forbade us to chew it. We were never allowed. But this product is simply amazing. Explain to us whatever gave you the idea of making chewing gum. Is it like a big market?
It is a big market. So right now, the chewing gum market is really dominated by two companies, Mars and Mondelez. Mars, which owns Wrigley, and Mondelez, which owns a number of other brands. So I started the company a few years back, and the idea came to me because I've always been interested in natural products, and I've always liked chewing gum, and I just wasn't able to find a natural option in the market. And as I did more research, I realized that conventional chewing gum, the kind of gum that you see at drugstores and supermarkets all over the country and all over the world, is actually completely synthetic and made of plastic. So the plastic is actually found on the label under the term gum base, which sounds innocent, but actually is a catch-all phrase for over 80 synthetic ingredients. And that alarmed me, and I was stunned that there were no truly natural options in the market, especially given that we live in a world where you can find natural premium products in just about every food category, as you know, whether it's cookies or chips or chocolate. So it was really, really fascinating how no one had managed to really create this concept of an all-natural chewing gum.
Hold on a minute. Curiously enough, but it used to be all-natural. You said
that's
until,
right.
Until all the 1950s. And it was actually, it goes back longer than that because didn't the natives in the Amazonian jungle, they actually chewed it, and that's where people got the idea.
Absolutely. And the Greeks chewed mastic, and various cultures around the globe have been chewing some variants of gum for thousands of years, as you correctly point out.
Now, why do people chew gum, and who chews gum?
People primarily chew gum for breath freshening, which is a form of social confidence. So it is a very social item. People offer it at parties, at meetings, and that sort of thing. So a lot of people do chew gum. The market is a large one. And in addition to breath freshening, we find that some people do chew for taste, for the flavor. And some people chew it has something to do. So if you're finicky or you need something to chew on or to concentrate, gum is often used for that.
Well, you know, I mean, you mentioned about flavor. I'm not a gum chewer to start with, but I had a problem with your gum because it tasted so good. I sort of went to swallow it. I decided I was supposed to do that.
Right. Well, and in our case, you can swallow it because we don't use any of the plastic. Our gum is biodegradable. So unlike the conventional gum, which you're not supposed to swallow, it'll just stay in your system.
Yeah, right.
Ours does degrade. Yeah. We, of course, you know, it's not meant to be swallowed, but if you did swallow it, nothing bad would happen.
But conventional gum just never goes away, right?
It never goes away, and so it actually contributes to a large amount of plastic waste as well.
And of course you see it all over the sidewalk, just everywhere.
Yeah,
exactly.
On your shoe, it's not a great thing.
Exactly.
So you say no plastic, no aspartame, and no synthetics, and these are made with only six ingredients. Organic dried cane juice, all-natural chiclet, which is that chewy part of it, organic vegetable glycerin, natural flavor, organic sunflower lecithin, and organic rice flour. Now, those all sound very healthy.
Yeah, and nothing toxic in those. The conventional gums, they throw in the aspartame, they throw in preservative, in addition to the synthetic plastic base. We wanted to stay away from artificial sweeteners. We wanted to stay away from artificial preservatives and artificial flavors. And so, as you'll notice, the gum itself looks different from regular gum.
Talk about that.
Yeah, so because we're not using artificial colors and coatings, the gum is a soft, round, I guess, brownish kind of ball.
I call them pellets. They look like
pellets, yeah.
They look like, you know, like if you had a pet rodent that you would feed.
So they look natural because they are natural.
It's kind of nice that the boxes look so good, which they do. The boxes are just absolutely enchanting.
Yeah,
thank you.
You must have spent a lot of time on design for these. We decided, Peter said it's a cuboid instead of a square. I always describe them as a 2-inch square. And you have it's very simple. Now this is simply gum, and your design is clean and simple. Like you'll just have the flavor, a photograph of an item in the flavor, such as you have a coffee bean for your coffee flavor, which, by the way, my daughter-in-law took that one. And so I never got to taste it, but she said she figured that her breath would...
It's one of my personal favorites.
Oh, is it?
The coffee, yes.
But wouldn't your breath smell of coffee?
Well, it's a very subtle kind of coffee flavor, but it's delicious. It's almost like a dessert substitute. So we do like the coffee. But yes, the packaging, they take a very long time. We wanted to elevate it to make it feel premium. And as you mentioned, to keep it aligned with our very kind of simple aesthetic and simple branding. So,
well, the design is simple, clean, and very sophisticated, as are the flavors, which I'm going to mention: cinnamon, ginger, maple, coffee, fennel licorice, and mint. Now, those are spectacular.
Thank you. And one thing I should also point out on the box is that we include those little post-chew wrapping papers. So if you look at the back, there are little individual papers. When you're done chewing, you can dispose of it that way.
I love this. First of all, when I opened the first package, I had no idea what I was going to find in there. I assumed I would have like a little sheet. Instead, I found all these little pellets. And then they were in the back, and in front of them are these really classy little squares of paper, thin paper, so that you take, and when you're finished chewing the gum, you wrap it tidily in one of these papers before discarding it. And I'll tell you, I have actually been in a high-class, you know, restaurant and got my dress caught under the table by somebody who had stuck gum under the table.
Okay.
I couldn't get out of the table booth.
Well, that's exactly why we include them, because how many times have you been at a restaurant where you need to dispose of your gum and you can't find a paper napkin, all napkins are cloth, and so this is one of the reasons why we did include those papers.
There is an interesting application of the use of gum that actually might interest you. we were reminded of it again last fall when we were in Verona in Italy for the second time. You undoubtedly know the story of Romeo and Juliet, which theoretically took place in Verona between two warring families who, of course, didn't even exist. But there's a Casa Giulietta, which supposedly was the home of Julia's family. And there's what do they call this? It's a balcony where Julia used to come and Romeo used to climb up the balcony. But around the surroundings of the courtyard, entering this back part of the house, people leave little love notes. And, of course, they need something to make them adhere. So they stick them to the wall with gum. And we noticed on this visit that the quantity was less.
But still there.
But it was still there. Apparently the city fathers made a major effort to have it all removed, but no sooner they did that than it all came back. But I'm sure that they would be delighted to know that there's a biodegradable gum.
I was unaware of this wall.
They would probably come out in support. You could certainly think of a neat advertising campaign, I think, for Casa Giulietta and gum and Simply Gum.
I mean, I think you should.
Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou? Simply Gum.
You should at least notify the municipality of Verona that there is such a thing. So it's a horrible cleanup. We were talking to somebody who lived there, and she said that it's a totally engrossing occupation to keep the place cleaned up.
Wow.
They can't stop it. But when he started about this gum, I thought you were going to tell the story about when our accelerator cable snapped.
I had forgotten about that. Here's an application where you actually need the gum to be permanent. My first car in the United States was a 1961 Volkswagen Bug, which had a wide variety of problems, including a problem which occurred one day when we were out playing tennis far across the city, and the throttle cable broke. So I thought, what on earth am I going to do about this? And then I used to chew gum when I played tennis in those days. So I thought, well, I tell you what, if I take all the gum I have and chew it up and make a big fat gob of gum, I can use it to wedge the throttle open.
That's what we did.
Oh, wow.
And have the effect of actually causing the accelerator to stay open and be able to move the car along. And we drove it about 5 miles. We did a steady 1,000 RPM.
Very clever usage of gum.
All the way across the center of the city of Philadelphia, and I couldn't stop. I had to keep going.
Tell me this. First of all, I think for such a new startup company, how you've been welcomed in all these upscale retail sources is amazing. We're all, can they find on retail this gum?
Yeah, so you can find the gum at Whole Foods, across most Whole Foods in the country. You can also find it at Sprouts, which is a natural chain on the West Coast. And you can find it on Amazon.com online.
Now, what do you have a store finder on your website?
Yes, you can find it on our website at simplygum.com.
Okay. And what kind of ad campaigns? I've never seen this advertised. I only saw it through the Fancy Food Show.
Right. Yes, right now we're not really doing any advertising. Pretty much word of mouth at this point.
And essentially your stores are doing that for you, right?
That's right.
I mean, Whole Foods is promoting it with displays. I'm sure I've seen it in my local Whole Foods.
Exactly.
Well, I think it's absolutely an adorable product. And how often do I get to say that?
Yeah, a brilliant brilliant concept, and you can say, Simply Gum, where art thou, Simply Gum?
Thank you.
Please, do you speak French? Prochain.
I do not.
Well, research your name. I think that's really fascinating. I've never known anybody who was named Next before.
I will.
There was a computer called Next.
Yeah?
It was Steve Jobs' company after he got fired from Apple. Uh-huh. He founded a company called Next. He probably should have called it Prochain.
Prochain. Well, now, I guess your business plan is to continue building impact, in sales. And you probably aren't going to be adding new flavors right away, but that might be in the back of your head, huh? But there,
absolutely.
You cover all bases with the flavors.
Yeah, so right now we have those six, but we're always working on others, and so may see some new ones rolling out at some point in the future.
Well, congratulations on a really ingenious product, and I hope that everybody adopts this.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
So there you have it. Who knows where we'll go, what we'll sample to eat next week. You better just come back and join us again, same time, same place. And until then,
bye-bye.